talk about different things.
Okay, and I'm Craig Maloney from Carnegie Mellon. You guys will see in a second what I'm going to be talking about. So I want to start by thanking Michael and Sri and Takeshi, who's not here, for inviting me to this wonderful place. So I spent some time here. I did my PhD with Jim Langer, and it's good to be back in Santa Barbara. It really feels like home. So anyway, so I'm going to be talking about some things that I did earlier during a postdoc with Mark Robbins, and then later some more things that I've been doing more recently since I arrived at CMU. I don't want to steal all of Mark's thunder here, because if you remember, we had Rob Hoy a couple weeks ago talking about the strain hardening, and then Jorg was talking about the aging at the end of last week. So I will leave most of the avalanche business to Mark for when he tells us about this later, and I will talk more about how things are structured in real space rather than the actual avalanches themselves. Okay, so plan of attack. Basically, we're going to break the talk into three parts. I'll just give you a sort of a general introduction, and then the results come in sort of two groupings. Grouping number one, I'm going to talk about the slip lines that form in Leonard Jones glasses when you shear them slowly at low temperature. And then in the second part of the talk, I'm going to be talking about some more recent results that I've been working on at CMU involving the jamming transition and what happens to these ideas that we find useful in describing Leonard Jones glasses when you get to these random packings of repulsive particles that have a very interesting transition when you approach their random closed packing point. Okay, so first of all, this is for Sri's benefit, my what question am I asking slide. So really what we're going to be thinking about is for simple amorphous solids in what I'm calling the athermal quasi-static limit, right? So I have no temperature, I'm shearing the systems very slowly. Two questions I want to ask. What is the elementary mechanism or mechanisms which accommodate the applied shear strain, right? So this is more, I'm thinking in sort of kinematic framework. I just want to shear the system and describe what I see, what's the result of the shear. There may be other barriers or accessible states. I'm just focusing on a kinematic description of how things are, what are these elementary mechanisms, how do they organize in space and time. Of course, if we want to get to practical aspects, we have to talk about how these things impact the viscoplastic rheology. People have stories about how the structure of these objects impacts the actual rheology. For the present purposes of this talk, I want to stay away from those sorts of more higher level questions. So the
because you're
I'm tiptoeing. Yes, I'm tiptoeing around the subject matter right now. So I'm sure we'll hear much more about these topics in the next few weeks. Okay. So anyway, the types of amorphous solids I have in mind, you can think about emulsions or foams and soft matter, granular packings. One of the more interesting types of amorphous packings that people have been looking at recently are these glassy colloidal suspensions. Peter Shaw was here a few weeks ago, and he talked about these things. I wasn't here, but I did manage to see some of the talk online. And so what Peter's done here, so this is basically they have a microscope, so they're looking into a packing of colloidal particles, and if the system is prepared, if it's densified sufficiently rapidly, the colloidal particles pack into a glassy state. It's an amorphous state. It's solid-like in the sense that you don't really see any appreciable diffusion on the time that you watch, but there's no structural ordering. And what Peter has done here is he's sheared the system, and he still continues to look with his microscope, and he's using a procedure similar to a procedure that Serge at Sengupta was telling us about before, where you look locally and you see where particles have deformed affinely relative to their neighborhood, and he's basically trying to fit, make a best fit affine, a best fit shear of the neighborhood, and he highlights particles in red that have sheared a lot. Okay, and so what he sees is that there are localized regions where you have very large shear strain that accommodates the imposed flow, and over time these localized pockets of intense shear sort of fill up the space more or less homogeneously. Okay, so this is a very nice system where we can actually look at these rearrangements microscopically. From a technological point of view, real atomic or molecular systems like metallic glasses may be more interesting, but unfortunately in that case, we can't go in with a microscope and look at individual atoms. Okay, so what we do see when we look at systems like this Here we've got, this is a sample from Jan Schors when he was with Bill Johnson at Caltech. This is a platinum-based metallic glass in compression. Scale bar here is about 200 microns, so when they put it in compression, what you see is you get on each of these shear bands that forms, you get a few microns worth of slip. So it's, you know, quite a bit of slip on each of these bands, and the spacing between these guys is a few tens of microns. And so, you know, my question is there some kind of connection we can make to the more microscopic atomistic picture that we were just seeing from Peter Schall and these other length scales that might be coming in atomic or molecular glasses? Yeah.
I mean, so looking, obviously this happens in the metallic glasses, but to what extent do we have evidence that we see analogous things in the other
in
systems?
Colloidal suspensions.
In granular packings and emulsions.
So if you go back to the original bubble raft experiments that Ali Argon was looking at when he wrote his seminal papers in the late 70s, those bubble rafts, you can more or less clearly, well, I would say when I look at the papers, you clearly see these features where you have lines of slip, where you have, you know, adjacent rows of bubbles sliding past each other that essentially go through the cell that they're using to shear those bubble rafts.
But those are not persistent in the way that the shear bands are.
Those are not persistent in the way that these shear bands are. So I don't want to claim that there's any direct connection between these sorts of experimental systems where we can observe the individual particle rearrangements and these atomic molecular systems where you get persistent shear bands with a lot of slip on each of these bands. That's sort of the ultimate goal. And in fact I will not be able to answer directly that question here. How the microscopic rearrangements that we can see in these systems relate to the more mesoscopic or even macroscopic rearrangements we see over here.
How thick are these shear bands? How many atoms across? They look like lines here, but length scale. You have any idea? Maybe 100.
The width is about a couple of nanometers. Okay. And the length is just a sample length. It goes all the way through.
But the width of the space.
The width of the
shear band and the spacing.
I'm more interested in the width.
Nanometers.
And a couple of nanometers.
Yes, a couple of nanometers.
So it's only a few.
Yes.
Only a few
couple of atoms. Yes.
So there's a whole. In other words,
because less than that.
Yeah.
So very large shear strains then in the band.
I wanted to comment on the statement about persistent. I mean, these. As I understand it, normally these shear bands form and they accommodate shear for a very small period of time and then they become inactive. So they're not persistent and they're not continuing to accommodate shear later on. I thought that you kept getting more shear bands as a function of time because each one activated for a short period of time and accommodated strain for that interval.
Well, a lot of that depends on the geometry of the sample.
Right, but...
Right. So, I mean, if you have a uniaxial compression test like you have here, oftentimes you'll get new shear bands forming, but if you do a tension test, that's not often the case here.
And you just get failure after as soon as one of them nucleates, I thought.
And, well, after you have some amount of slip accommodated by that shear band.
But I guess these are more like shear cracks.
And so why would you say that it's more like a shear crack?
Well, they're very thin.
Yeah.
And they're moving very fast, so they're almost disconnected.
If you put on a tension, which you should do actually in the real experiments, after the shear bands go through the way, the opening occurs, the cracking occurs, and the catastrophic fading. We wouldn't probably talk about that.
No, happens
then. Mm-hmm. So this is stabilized actually due to the compression test. It closes
the
slip.
The angle is the angle of direction and maximum shear stress.
Mm-hmm. On longer 45 degrees.
Yeah, but then there's pressure.
There's pressure on the opening. So we have it.
So has anybody characterized how much slip is accommodated, much strain is accommodated on each band?
I mean, you just measure the steps. You measure the surface steps,
right,
basically.
So a few microns of slip.
Yeah. And then so that, so if you know how much you've compressed it, then you, if you know the amount of slip on a given one, you know what the spacing has to be.
So we don't know whether that happens all at once.
We don't know whether that happens all at once, or like Mark was saying, if they, you know, if they're active for some period of time. I don't know if that's known.
I was saying it's for a fairly short
period. Okay, so each of them turns on.
But a few microns of slip is a lot of slip.
A few microns of slip is obviously a lot of slip.
A lot of slip, but small.
So I'm comparing this picture with the colloidal suspensions.
Yeah.
Am I looking for similarities or?
Well, the question is how might, and so I'm not going to make a direct connection between this sort of level and the sort of level where you see a few microns of slip along one of the bands. But the, you know, the questions are how, if we think at the, you know, the atomistic level, how might some kind of, how might there be some kind of mechanism for organization into these bands? It's still an open question. But, okay, so I guess the upshot of all of that was that this may have been a horribly misleading picture, and instead of this picture, I could have shown, like Michael was asking about, one of these bubble raft experiments where you show a clear single slip line forming in the bubble raft. Okay, but there do exist those things too.
And if each one increases.
Okay, so of these, yeah.
Is there some understanding of when these different pictures are relevant? I mean, meaning what conditions under which you have these shear cracks, as Jim was saying. When you have these, compact-looking non-affine regions.
You know, so I think the question is still open. Jim did some early work on some of these things where there was, you know, this mechanism that I will talk about sort of gave rise to some sort of correlated slipping of the material. I'll say more about the mechanism in the atomistic context later. But if you, in that picture, I think Jim was always, at least as he explained it to me, was always pessimistic because there wasn't really any mechanism that set any characteristic length scale, right? So
I think that data was entirely wrong.
Yeah. Okay. So pessimistic is. Pessimistic was an understatement. Okay. So I'm not tiptoeing successfully. Okay.
I'm dead serious.
Okay. But anyway, so suffice it to say, it's an open question. I think there's a lot of confusion in the community about what it is that gives some kind of mechanism for microns worth of slip on those bands. Okay, and so if you think about these, you know, basically the four kinds of systems I was thinking about: the emulsions, the soft matter, the granular materials, the real molecular glasses, and the colloids. You know, there are lots of differences in what's going on in the microscopic physics, right? So you can have, the systems can either have inertia, they can be overdamped. The real room temperature KT may matter, or it may be completely irrelevant. The mechanism for dissipation in the colloid, you might imagine that you have hydrodynamics, right? And there's drag between the particles when they rearrange. That could be important. So lots of things that may make a difference, but there's at least one school, one point of view that says we might be able to capture some kind of flavor of what's going on in all these different systems from a basic energy landscape picture. And so this cartoon is basically due to Melandre and Lax, and the idea is that, you know, if you have the system that's sitting in some mechanically stable state, if I shear my system at least at zero temperature, it doesn't really do anything. It tracks this local minimum until you destabilize the local minimum, and then the system has to rearrange somehow. And then the structure, if I look at the energy or the stress as a function of time, it's completely controlled by shear-induced changes to the potential energy landscape. And to the extent that in this athermal quasi-static limit, where we turn off the temperature, we drive the system very slowly, we can ignore the dynamics, then what you see is going to be controlled by the shear-induced changes to the energy landscape. Okay, so that's one point of view. And so in order for us to be in this regime where we might hope to recover all the physics by thinking just about the energy landscape, we have to have this separation of time scales. So we have to have that the time scale for thermally induced reorganization is very long compared to the time scale we're inducing, we're putting in by hand by the drive, which has to be very long compared to the amount of time it takes for the system to rearrange once we've destabilized it. So if we do have the separation of time scales, there's at least a hope that we could ignore some of the details in the microscopic particle scale physics.
We talk about the shear time scale, when it really yields and comes down?
I'm just talking about the strain rate. So we're straining, so we're mechanically, you know, the system's not going to do anything unless we're straining it, right? Yes. So we're imposing some time scale by the drive. And so we have to have these, you know, so we have to be shearing it slowly enough such that when I destabilize it, it has time to rearrange, whatever amount of time it needs to go through that rearrangement process. I'm not going to be driving it so fast that I cut off that rearrangement process. I'm going to let it fully relax on its own. But on the other hand, I can't be driving, if we're at finite temperature, and it does do some spontaneous rearranging, I can't be driving it so slowly that it's going to thermally relax before I trigger one of these events, right? So those two time scales have to be separated out.
One actually said something to Jim was asking about how fast actually it goes through. It is picoseconds where the system, the shebangs evolves just with some very fast.
So T rearrange could depend on, well, it's long and it could depend on these microscopic details, right? So the kind of system you're thinking about, there might be different T rearrange. But if there is some limit where you can separate these timescales in any of these kinds of systems, then you might imagine this energy landscape picture would be the right picture to think about to try to understand the stress strain curves and whatnot.
This T rearrange.
Yeah.
In a crystal, is it the recrystallization time?
Shear induced. So this essentially is the thermal stuff, and this is essentially the athermal stuff. So
recrystallization time will be the T thermal.
I think so.
The time for smaller grains to form and remove the effects of shear.
T rearrange would be something on order of the glide rate. Right, in a
yeah, so there'd be some. So if you're thinking about dislocations, it'd be set by the drag coefficient for the dislocation. The dislocation mobility would be one over the dislocation mobility would be the thing that sets T rearrange. But so anyway, I think in these systems, T rearrange is just set by whatever damping mechanism you put in, right? So for the granular materials, it might have something to do with the friction at the contacts. For the colloids, it might have something to do with the drag of the suspending fluid, something like that. Okay. And so in order to get to this, if there is a separation of timescales, it's possible in that system. The way you get there is, you think about first setting the temperature to zero. And after you set the temperature to zero, then you take the strain rate to zero. So this is sort of the limit that we're thinking about to start with. And then we'll see later. So I won't talk about it, but people are thinking seriously about how to extend the picture to non-zero strain rate, non-zero temperature. And so I should say that there, when I say zero temperature, there are many different, of the classes of systems I'm thinking about, there are many different zero temperature systems that are not all equivalent and have different damping mechanisms. So the hope is that may not matter if we're in this limit. Okay, so what are we doing? So we're just going to be doing, everything I'm going to talk about here is going to be 2D, at least for the first part of the talk, it's going to be binary Leonard-Jones, and later I'm going to talk about a soft sphere kind of model. So I prepare my system with a very violent quench, so essentially from infinite temperature. I just go down as fast as I can in energy. I quench the system at zero pressure, so my initial state is at zero pressure, but then I start to shear it, and I shear it at fixed area, so the pressure may go up depending on the preparation. So I'm going to take, be very careful when I say zero temperature molecular dynamics, because it could mean any one of a number of things. What I mean here when I say that I do zero temperature molecular dynamics is that I have a constant viscosity zero temperature thermostat. So just put on some damping, and I'm damping the relative motion of the particles. And so in a continuum context, you might call this Kelvin damping. It's a lot like what goes on in dissipative particle dynamics. So I'm damping relative motion of particles. So Mark, maybe later, when he talks about our work on avalanches, we'll talk about what happens when you change the microscopic damping mechanism. Okay, so I'm using periodic boundary conditions all the way around. And so the one point of this work, one piece that's novel that people hadn't looked at before, we're just really going to systems that are, one or two orders of magnitude bigger in a number of particles, about one order of magnitude bigger in length than people had looked at before. And we need to get to these large length scales because we're trying to look at scaling behavior. And when we get to these large, very large systems, it's somewhat heroic. And so this is a cluster, some of the simulations I'm talking about are about, 3-4 years old now, so these numbers have come down a little bit, but, on the order of 500 CPU days per run, because A, we have a big system, B, we want to make sure that we're in this quasi-static regime so that, tau drive is much longer than tau relax. And so the upshot of that is that if we really try hard to push down to this quasi-static regime, the applied strain is really playing the role of a time, and there is no real time per se. So I will refer to rates how things change with respect to the applied strain. Okay, and so now how do I look at strains in my particulate system? So there are a couple different ways to do this. What I like to do, and I think I could do the same sort of thing using the kind of techniques that Michael introduced and Sergit was telling us about, where I try to fit a best fit strain tensor to a local neighborhood, but something that I think is a little bit simpler is I just triangulate my system. Okay, so I have two configurations. So the red is sort of the time one, and the black is sort of time two. And so after some elapsed time, I can look at my triangles, and I can see, I can try to fit, I have three displacements, and on each of those, I take each node of this triangle. So here I have two triangles, I have a top triangle and a bottom triangle. I have displacements at each of those nodes, and then those three displacements will give me a constant displacement gradient on that triangle, and I can look at various components of that displacement gradient tensor. So for instance, I can look at strain components. So this is essentially strain along the axes. This is strain 45 degrees away from the axes. I have a deviatoric strain. There's a volumetric strain, which would just be the sum of the xx and the yy. And so there's one component here, the antisymmetric piece of the displacement gradient tensor, which is the vorticity of the displacement field, which is something that people, you know, traditionally have not looked at a lot. And so I want to make one small point here, is that if you look at sort of the canonical Eshelby shear transformation, so this I've taken from Michael's PRV in 98, so I've just got a little a quartet of atoms here, and I'm they start out in this configuration. If I'm compressing the system on the vertical axis, they're going to want to go from some configuration like this over to some configuration like that. And if I have some symmetric canonical Eshelby transformation, I'm going to have axial shear strain. The other shear that's 45 degrees away from the axes is going to be turned off, and there's going to be no vorticity, right? So I have some symmetry here going from something that's in this direction to something that's extended in the other direction. And that is sort of, you should contrast that with a picture more like the canonical shear transformation that if you look at Argonne seminal 79 Acta et al. Paper, you know, he really referred to this thing as nascent dislocation loop, right? And so there is some difference between this nascent dislocation loop and a canonical symmetric Eshelby transformation, because over here, so this zone is responding to vertical compression. What goes on is I have, you know, these, so I start out with the red atoms, my red atoms move to the blue atoms, so these guys are moving down to the right, these guys are moving up to the left. I still have the same axial strain that's induced, but in this case, I have a choice for the vorticity. Right, so either I can have a configuration like this where I have a positive vorticity, or I have a configuration like this where I have a negative vorticity. Okay, and so I'll show you that when you look at the results of the simulation, it's very rare that you see an Eshelby transformation that hasn't committed to one of the two senses of vorticity. Right, and it's much more common that we see something that looks like this, where we really have some local slipping plane that has decided which of the two axes it wants to slip on. Okay. Okay, so what do you get? These are the results of a simulation of a 1,000 by 1,000 2D binary Leonard-Jones that I was just describing. So this, in this column, I've got what you get when you compare 6% to 6.1% applied strain. Here's 6.0 to 6.2, and here's 6.0 to 6.4. I'm plotting in the top row the magnitude of the local displacements, and in the bottom row I'm plotting the vorticity of the displacement field, just defined as I talked about on local triangles. And what you see is that the system certainly does select one or the other of these two vorticity states. So I'm compressing vertically here, and I guess I picked a color scheme where black means that I have a positive clockwise vorticity, and white means that I have a negative counterclockwise vorticity. And so you see my clockwise guys, as I look at the vorticity field, line up in extended features exactly where you'd expect. If I'm compressing the system like this, I expect it to slide like that, right? And so I have positive vorticity here. And then what you see, if I continue to strain and I go out from 6.1 all the way over to 6.4, I still have that same feature that was there in the first window, but now the system is starting to localize along another feature that's on the opposite slip system, right? So in other words, we have this interplay between one flavor of vorticity and the other flavor of vorticity, and the system tends to go back and forth between these two vorticity states, because on the whole, after a long time, we can't induce any spontaneous rotation into the system. So we have to have the positive vorticity countering with the negative vorticity. Okay, and so if we just look at that same event, so we're going to look at this this should be 6.0 to 6.1, the exact same configuration we were just looking at. And if I go into a little more detail and I ask, well, what happens if I just walk, I'm going to plot the transverse component of the displacements as I'm moving through the system along some line. Okay, so here in the top, I'm plotting the, you know, sort of the northeast, if you will, displacement field as I move in the northwest direction. And you see this very complicated structure in these sharp drops. If I plot instead down here, if I plot the southeast displacements, as I move in a northwest direction, you see these big slips that come in, right? So I have large transverse displacement discontinuities here. And if we just try to read off some numbers from the plots, so again, this is for a system that's 1,000 by 1,000. My box is 1,000 by 1,000. And you can read off here the width of the shear band. Well, this, I don't know. I'll be careful when I call it a shear band. So this transient slip line is the language that I've become fond of recently. So this transient slip line has a width of about 50 particles. It has an amplitude you can read off just by looking at the displacements here. It jumps by about a couple particle spacings. So it's got an amplitude of about 1 to 2 particle spacings on it, which means that inside the shear zone, I have a strain of on between 2 and 4%. And so since I know the slip amplitude and I know the size of my system, I've unloaded about the slip amplitude divided by the length, so I've unloaded about 0.1% strain globally. So in some sense, I'm looking on this window of 0.1% strain, and since my slip amplitude, my typical slip amplitude here is about one particle spacing, my system is about 1,000 particles across, I've unloaded the applied strain in that interval. Okay, and so you see these curves have a very interesting, rich, potentially fractal structure, and we'll come back to that later.
The shear rate is small?
So the shear rate is small enough that we believe we're rate independent. So we work very hard, and we spend a lot of CPU cycles making sure that we're in that regime where we are rate independent.
And it starts out somewhere, okay? I mean, it's must be, when the first one started, it was T's and they all for the same trend, isn't it true?
No, so okay, so what I'm claiming that we're in steady state flow at this point, right? And so you might argue with me, so for the cartoons, for these examples that I'm showing you, my case study right here, it's sort of an early regime, 6% strain. We take data at later strains, okay? So you could argue with that. But we believe that you will see over time, I'll make this a little clearer. So here's what's going on between 6.0 and 6.1% strain, between 6.0 and 6.2, between 6.0 and 6.4. So you have something that's initially localized over here, right? But as you continue to strain, you see new features develop over here, and then now the system is slipping along, I haven't plotted it, but between 6.3 and 6.4, it's primarily along this region here, and these guys have extinguished themselves more or less. And so we believe that over time, the system sort of fills up homogeneously, and there's no persistent localization at all. So in this sense, it's very different than the persistent shear bands that I was showing you from Jan Schorer's experiment. The question is how these features we see at the microscopic level might relate to these larger scale features, and so that's open.
Was there some degree of initial randomness or something in the system to get it
quench? Yes, so quench as violently as possible. So we effectively go from an infinite temperature, the particles start out in random locations, they're pushed apart by a soft potential. At some point you turn on Leonard Jones, you put on a zero pressure barostat and let it come to equilibrium at zero pressure, then you do volume preserving shear and let the pressure does what it will. Yeah, Sid.
So Craig, you have a big system and you run very long.
Yes.
And we say the shear rate is slow.
Yes.
How slow is that?
It's slow enough that we believe,
minus something.
So on the time scale, the relevant time scale here is actually set by, we think the relevant time scale is by the damping parameter we put in. And so in those units where you know, naively at a very small strain rate. So say 10 to the minus 6 in those units that are set by the damping parameter. Okay. Now, we have shown that the structure of these the rearrangement, so if you look at the spatial structure of the vorticity field, it does not depend on rate. So we're shearing slowly enough that we're in a rate-independent regime, and which is 10 to the minus 6 in the appropriate dimensionless naive units.
I was going to say there's actually something of an anti-correlation, right? We've looked at the spatial correlations, and it seems if we get a slip band in a region, there's actually the next one's likely to be some distance away rather than right. nearby, mm-hmm. which might or might not be related to the fact that you see shear bands, and then shear bands, the next one, come in some distance away. Mm-hmm. It seems like that shear band's screened the fields or whatever, yeah. and so it's more likely for something to happen a little distance away.
Yeah, and so
you could think that it's essentially you're shear annealing it, right? And in the sense that you've started from such a highly energetic state that there's no other way to get to lower parts of the energy landscape. So if you shear it, it actually is essentially helping it anneal.
Just to understand what that means, so it's the idea that if you create this slip lane, the particles on either side can sort of get into more stable structures.
But that's what he's saying, and I guess my concern about that statement is that we've gone to 6% strain, mm-hmm. and at that point, every particle has sheared, and so somehow all the particles should be in some rejuvenated state. Now, maybe they're able to relax closer to their energy minimum just because there's no shear on there, or maybe...
But isn't that something that would be, like, if you looked at the potential energy as a function of shear, wouldn't you have...
It's constant.
Does it go down, or just...
Well, it goes no down in each one of these jumps, but it's statistically constant.
I mean, look away from the plane.
I was just thinking overall average.
Okay. The energy of your very first detergent yeah. sample and after the deformation, is the energy of the...
No, the energy goes up, of course.
Energy goes
well,
up.
You say, of course, but not necessarily. Because
you can work hard.
Very quickly, you start
yeah,
with
you
very
can,
high energy, and then,
sure.
as Michael was saying, the deformation could give a way to the for the sample to anneal.
And it does at the beginning at very small strains, the energy can go down a little bit. But when you get up into the flow regime, the energy is certainly higher than it was in the unsheared state.
No, it goes down and then it goes up again?
We really quench these things hard.
No, but I'm just...
Yes, it does go down. Yes, it does go down.
I think it would be monotonic, at least, whether it's...
So let me put it this way. Let me put it this way. So I know that I've prepared systems violently enough such that when I initially start to strain the thing, you can get the energy to go down for very little bit before you get up into some kind of an elastic regime. But I guess you must have
you're putting elastic energy in, right? So there's an elastic energy due to the shear stress, which is quite big. Mm-hmm. That's building up, and but then you're sort of getting closer to the, you know, maybe annealing out some unpleasant regions initially. So you can get an initial drop followed by the rise. If you were to remove the shear stress and go back to zero stress,
yeah.
you might find you were at a lower energy.
Right. I mean, yeah.
That's but that's, but that's,
you have to compare to zero stress to zero stress.
That's not what he's talking about, and I don't think we've done that.
Oh.
But in other samples, I've done that, and yes, it's fairly easy to get an overaging kind of effect where if you shear cycle, you don't go up to yield, you come back, and you're at a lower energy state.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't. But I think all this
expected it to somehow relax monotonically to some steady state, right?
In the energy.
If you looked at the potential energy in the unstressed state.
Yeah.
Before and after, stop periodically, unstressed, mm-hmm.
right.
the potential energy.
Yeah.
I would have expected that it would relax monotonically to some steady state. That's right. I mean, and so either you're relaxing down or you're mm-hmm. relaxing up. And
yes.
So you're saying you're relaxing down, or.
So you're saying I'm comparing the unloaded energy to the virgin energy,
right.
and so so I think I can. I think that I can prepare the sample in either way, that I can get it to go monotonically up or that I can get it to do a little dip.
But these you quenched as violently as you can.
Yeah. Yeah, but at any rate, so I think all the statements I'm making are, you know, we're in a steady state regime.
That is independent of the preparation.
That is independent of the preparation protocol.
So you're saying the screening occurs not just before you've reached steady state?
That's what Mark was saying, and so I think that's probably right.
Yeah, we did look at the correlation.
We didn't look as seriously as some other people have at that sort of effect, right? You're talking about spatial, like the likelihood of the next event, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can okay. you tell from the particles alone where the last event was? I mean, forget about any information about previous slips or anything, just from the configuration.
No, it's very subtle. If you look at changes, for instance, if you look at changes in stress, so Mark has some pretty pictures from Mike Salerno's work, where if you look at the change in the stress field, you see a nice stress concentration at the end of one of these guys that has not made it all the way through the system, sort of like, you know, some stress concentration at a crack tip. But if you're talking about looking at not change in the stress, but just actual instantaneous stress values or some sort of, you know, elastic moduli or some sort of local structures, it's very difficult to say anything about where the yielding will happen. Mm-hmm. But so I know some people are thinking harder about how to, you know, look at elastic moduli of mesoscale regions to try to extract that sort of predictive ability about where the thing is going to yield.
So I guess if I were looking at a finite rate, mm-hmm. right, so generally what I would expect is that if you look at it, unloaded energies in the steady state, mm-hmm. the faster you're shearing, the higher that energy will be, right?
It's not obvious.
You're in this very low rate regime.
Right. We're in this low rate regime, but I mean, so I could make the other. So let me see. So Sri is saying that if you would expect naively that if you're shearing faster, the unloaded energy would be higher, and I can make a counter argument. I can say, well, if you're shearing faster, even though we're at zero temperature, shearing faster puts you further away from zero temperature, and there might be some sort of extra annealing that goes on, so that when you if you stop, then you unload. You may be coming from a more well annealed state. So I think it could go either way. And so one thing that Mark has seen with Mike Salerno is that if you add, depending on whether or not you have inertia in the dynamics, so this is all finite inertia with damping. You can kill the inertia completely, and that changes the steady state energy even in quasi-static flow. The flowing energy, not even the unloaded energy. So these things I think can go either way.
I mean, you could reasonably expect, I think, that what you're saying is true, but that there's some limiting value mm-hmm. that you go to in the quasi-static limit, which they claim they're in.
Right, no, but if they're doing it so slow that, in fact, you know, so if my correlation was correct, that for faster rates, I would go up to higher energies. Mm-hmm. Then if I work back, I should be actually... Eventually, I'm optimizing the system completely by sort of shearing it at a very
slow rate. You can. Right? Yeah.
So that would mean that, in fact, the energy should keep going down.
Why? Why not getting asymptotically approaching some ideal slow shear energy?
It's probably not. I would expect these systems to be very far away from. Any kind of annealed glass.
No, not anneal. I'm not saying anneal.
So you're saying that it must go to some limit, right? That's what
I'm saying. It must go to some limit that's far above, that's maybe closer to what like the glass transition temperature would be. Not that you could shear it slower and slower and get to some annealed glass. And I think that's what you're going to see. That's what I hear you saying.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's true.
Okay, but anyway, so I think I went back to this slide to answer a question from Conrad about the clarification about the fact that the shear actually does fill up the whole system. While I'm on the slide, I should point out one other non-obvious feature, is that if you try to use displacements to try to figure out where the system is rearranging, I want to argue that that's a bad thing to do, because if you see in one of these bands, actually in the core of the shear band where the strain is very high, the displacements are actually small compared to the surrounding material, right? So that's just an aside. Might be obvious after the fact, but so you can see that from this picture here. Of course, the displacements are going to be largest sort of outside the outside the zone, and in the core, they actually do tend to be small. Okay, so what we're going to look at here is if I just plot in 8 consecutive windows that are at that same strain interval of 0.1%, I'm just going to make a PDF, I'm going to make a histogram for individual configurations of the displacement in the X and the Y direction. And what you'll see is that the system actually, it tends to be in one or the other of these vorticity states. So it either tends to be slipping with a positive vorticity or with a negative vorticity, and there's some oscillation back and forth. So here we have something that's essentially, Gaussian and more or less symmetrical, so the system's in a quiescent state. And then here, in the next 0.1% strain snapshot, we see that I have a lot of displacement on the towards the northwest and the southeast. So it's in one of these states that's polarized this way. And then if I so these are not individual avalanches. So here we're already at the at the scale of many avalanches. We're looking at the effect of a buildup of correlated avalanches, and so this is the end result of that buildup of correlated avalanches. And so the avalanches are all correlated on strain scales less than 0.1%, right? And so after 0.1% is when the correlations, the avalanches have built up one of these shear zones, and then they go on somewhere else in the system, right? So we're looking at, on this strain scale, which is sort of above the avalanche time. And so you see here, we have one of these guys polarized this way, and there it continues a little bit, and then the system becomes quiescent again. You strain for a little more, and it starts to activate on the conjugate slip system. You see this back and forth between the two slip systems. Okay, and we can use this picture to build up a story of what's going on and have some stochastic model in our minds of individual particle displacements. Okay, so if I believe that I have these slip bands coming in all the time, my slip band can either be striking, so here what I'm doing, now I'm looking at the PDF of just the northeast displacements as in these same 8 consecutive windows, and you can see that when the system's active, like for instance in this red plot right here, the system was active along that slip system, my PDF of displacement along that direction is essentially flat up to the slip amplitude A, right? So it could be anything. It's equally likely up to that maximum slip amplitude. And when the system is quiescent, I have something that's more or less Gaussian, right? So I have it's either flat or it's not doing very much. And then so if I just approximate the PDF of displacement as something that's flat up to some amplitude A, then I can just do a little bit of geometry. If I find the variance of this distribution, then the mean square displacement per one of these slipping events is going to be the slip amplitude squared over 12. The factor of 12 just comes from finding the variance of that guy. So if you imagine that at larger time intervals, these things just add up incoherently, then I should get something diffusive, and I should be able to back out a diffusion constant. And so the total mean squared displacement is going to be the number of events in a given time interval times the mean squared displacement per event. So the number of events in a given time interval is going to be the strain, the total strain applied, divided by the strain unloaded in an event. And then I have my factor of mean squared displacement per event. So at the end of the day, it tells me that the mean squared displacement goes like the applied strain, and I have a factor of the system size times the slip amplitude over 12. And so I have something like a diffusion constant, but the diffusion constant depends on system size, right? So effectively what's going on is because this event rate, right, I have a 1 over L in my event rate, right? So I'm sorry, I have a factor of L in my event rate. So the events are becoming more frequent as I get to a larger and larger system, because the strain that I'm unloading goes down because my system size goes up, which means my event rate has to go up, which means my effective diffusion constant, if you like to call it that, must go up with system size. Okay, and so we can actually.
And this is independent of temperature completely.
This is all, so everything is at low temperature, and you would imagine that finite temperature serves to sort of squelch the avalanches and would limit the limit this sort of system size effect. Okay, and the quantitative way that comes in is it's an open question. Okay, and so if we look at the displacement PDFs, so these displacement PDFs, they look a lot like what you see in normal supercooled, I shouldn't say normal supercooled, in supercooled liquids. And so in supercooled liquids, at early times, you see large exponential tails in the displacement PDFs. And then as you go to later and later times, eventually you have to cross over to some thickening behavior where you go back to a Gaussian, and the mean square displacement is scaling just like the applied time. And so we see something very similar here, but I want to point out it comes from a very different microscopic place. So again, the diffusion the effective diffusion coefficient depends on system size. So it's certainly not the kind of diffusion that we're used to thinking about. And the point is that as we get for delta gamma to be 0.1%, which is the strain intervals we were just looking at, you see it's very exponential. You get almost seven decades of exponential decay, and you get a crossover to Fickian behavior, and the point at which you cross over to Fickian behavior, we can make an argument that if we go back and we look at the width of these shear bands, and we look at the frequency of events, the crossover seems to be happening at the point at which a finite width shear band ends up filling the system, more or less. And so if you back out a number for the slip amplitude, you see that we have an effective diffusion coefficient, and from that effective diffusion coefficient, I infer that my slip amplitude must be about 0.7 particle diameters. That's right around the same ballpark of the displacement amplitude we were looking at when we were just sort of looking at the case study of those couple of snapshots, right? So we get something that looks like it's consistent here. And so we haven't, so in this particular study that I'm talking about here, we haven't looked so carefully at the size dependence, but in other systems we have checked that you do get this scaling. You get this very dramatic going from systems that are 100 by 100 all the way up to systems that are 1,000 by 1,000. We see the scaling of the effective diffusion coefficient. Okay, so that was for displacements. But really, the take-home point of this is that displacements in these solid-like materials might not be the best variables to be looking at. So if instead of looking at the displacement PDFs, we look at these vorticity PDFs, even when the displacement PDFs have crossed over and they're perfectly Fickian, we get the mean squared displacement scaling like the applied strain, the vorticity has these very pronounced exponential tails, and they stay out to these relatively large strains. And so what I'm showing you here, this is the vorticity PDFs going from windows of size 0.1% strain all the way up to 1.6% strain. So with increasing strain, you get more. So first of all, you have these exponential tails, and you have a core of particles that have not, well, I should say triangles that have not really sheared so much, right? So this is the vorticity equals zero triangles. You've got a lot of those guys that have not participated in one of these shear bands. And this is nothing like when I'm making my PDF of displacement, a slip line affects everybody, not just the guys in the shear zone. If I make a PDF of vorticity, the only guys that are really turned on are the guys that are in the core of that zone. And so essentially, if I look at the weight in these tails, it keeps going up and up and up as I shear the system, and more particles, more triangles, have participated in the plasticity. And so if you believe what's going on, we have this picture where I'm incoherently adding up these slip bands. What should be happening is my tails should be becoming more populated, and the total population in the tails should grow linearly with the applied strain as I induce more and more plasticity. So if I rescale by the applied strain, I almost get a collapse of the tails. And so to the extent that these guys don't collapse, it means that there is some kind of correlation, like so a triangle that has slipped is more likely to slip again or less likely to slip again. Otherwise, these guys would have collapsed on top of themselves. It's interesting, you can play a game. If we believe that what's going on is some sort of uncorrelated process, I can do an autoconvolution of the short time omega PDFs to get longer time omega PDFs. And when you do that, you do get a perfect collapse. And you do get a nice exponential form, but here we must have some residual correlation. But the take-home is that if I look at the characteristic omega from the exponential decay, I get something that's in the ballpark of 0.1. Okay, and if I convert a vorticity to a strain, there's a factor of 2, just because I'm doing the symmetrized version of the displacement gradient. And that factor of 2 tells me that the characteristic strain associated with this characteristic vorticity is about 5%. Now, if you look at the yield strain for these materials, it's also on the ballpark of 5%. So our conjecture is that this the exponential decay is actually related to the yield strain in the material, ballpark 5%. Okay, and again, just a take-home message, both the mean squared displacement and the mean squared vorticity are scaling in a perfectly Fickian way by by maybe, what is this, 0.2% applied strain, but that is not to say that what's going on with the vorticity is diffusion at all. It's not a diffusive process. Okay, so that is the end of part 1A of the talk, so I think I'm going to have to streamline or pick some things out at this point. But anyway, so the main message is that in at least in the system that's 1,000 by 1,000 that I was focusing on, we see the shears accommodated in bands of slip. They're transient bands. They move around in the system. They're not localized persistently. They have the amount of slip in a given band is about on the order of the particle size. The width is on the order of 50 particles across, which means that the strain in the band is on the order of 1%, but they relieve globally in the system 0.1%, just because I'm taking the slip amplitude divided by the system size. So this gives me a system size dependent effective time scale, right, below which my elementary events are somehow correlated, but above which I lose the correlations after my slip bands are fully formed, and that in this system is about 0.1%. So if we imagine that we have a flat elementary distribution of slips, I'm sorry, a flat elementary distribution of displacements, that gives us a some kind of stochastic model to back out an effective diffusion constant, which turns out to give a very good, nice, consistent estimate for the slip amplitude. Right, correct. And so now, okay, let's move on to the spatial structure. So everything so far we were talking about the statistics of single particle rearrangements. Now let's talk about how things are organized in space. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm looking at one of these vorticity fields. I'm going to take the vorticity field and I'm just going to find the power spectrum of the vorticity field. And I'm going to isolate different orientations of wave vector. Right? So I've color-coded things here. So black is actually for a horizontal wave vector, which corresponds to lines of constant phase that are vertical. Purple is going to be a vertical wave vector, and these other guys, intermediate wave vectors. And if I look at the power along each of those orientations, so first if I start at the black guy, which would correspond to vertical features, I get something that looks like a power law with an exponent that's pretty small. I get something that's very flat. Whereas if I go over towards this green, which is the guy along maximum shear, I get a very much larger exponent. So I still see something that looks like a power law, but I've got a much bigger slope here on the log-log plot. So if I look at the blue and the red, which are these intermediate orientations, if I believed all that mattered for the amount of power on a given orientation was the resolved shear stress on that orientation, blue should be exactly the same as red. They have the same resolved shear stress. My principal axes in these simulations are exactly vertical and horizontal where I'm applying the strain. But if I look at the power, red has a lot more power than blue. Okay? They look on the log-log plot like they have the same slope. Right? So if I imagine that I have some functional form like this for my structure factor, that I have an angle-dependent prefactor, and then I have an angle-dependent exponent, what's going on is that the red and the blue, they have the same exponent. The purple and the black, they have the same exponent, but they have different prefactors. So it looks like red is bigger than blue, right? And so red are the lines that are oriented more towards the horizontal. If you imagine what's going on microscopically, is that at the particle scale, I have some kind of a more Coulomb effect, right? So if I have an orientation that's closer to vertical, I have to first order, I have the same shear stress, but I have less normal stress on the orientation that's closer to the vertical, which explains why you might get more power along the red. Right? So it seems like there's a more Coulomb effect that's operating at the small scales, but as I renormalize and I go to larger scales, all that seems to matter is the shear stress along that given orientation. Okay. So again, we're looking at displacements, the vorticity of displacement fields on average, this is 4%, I'm sorry, this should be not 4%, this should be 0.4%, so sorry, there's a mistake there. But sort of on much longer times than individual avalanches that make up these slip lines. Right? So I'm looking at, yeah.
Yes. This exponent alpha, can you interpret that as something
like a problem? It's hard for us. So we've been trying to find where other people have talked about some kind of an angle dependent exponent. And geometrically, it's hard for me to understand what it means for there to be an angle-dependent exponent. So,
forget about the angle-dependence
Well, it's telling you. I mean, it's telling you something about the power spectrum of the transverse display. So remember, I'm looking at vorticity, right? And vorticity is related. Before I showed you those the transverse displacement plots. As I'm moving in one direction, I'm looking at the component of displacement perpendicular to the direction that I'm moving in. Mm-hmm. And so somehow I'm looking at the power spectrum of those sorts of features. Right? And so the fact that it's telling me that I have some scaling exponent tells me that there's some kind of self-similar structure in those transverse displacements.
What are the kind of values we have?
Oh, I'm sorry. So the value is in the ballpark. So if I do. If I do an angle average of these guys, so here, I mean, you can. So this is the effective exponent right here. So on this plot, this is just a log-log plot. Here I'm plotting the slope, right? So these guys are in the ballpark of, the purple and the black, are in the ballpark of somewhere between 0.5, and then the red and the blue are right around 0.75, and we do an average over angles of that angle-dependent exponent. I'll show in a second. So before I do that, I should compare. So we heard from Damien Vandenbroek last week that in their lattice model, they get a very similar kind of behavior, where if they look at the power spectrum on different orientations, they see, again, an angle-dependent exponent. But in their case, like Damien was telling us, there's a much more dramatic dependence on orientation. So they see effectively a very small exponent until they get on that direction of maximum shear, and then they get a very large, big jump in the exponent. Whereas we seem to have a more gradual transition from these intermediate orientations, the blue and the red, over to the maximum shear direction, which is green. Right? So they seem to see a big jump. And I think part of this may stem from the fact that in the lattice model, you really are considering these symmetrical Echelby transformations, right? You only have pure shear, whereas in what we see in the experiment is you do have simple shear. There is a component of vorticity involved, and that may be very important, especially relating to this this local Moore-Coulomb kind of effect. And so those are things that are not in the lattice model. And when you do the angle average exponent, we get something quite different than what they get. So anyway, so what I'm plotting now is I'm taking that effective exponent, I'm averaging over, I'm not plotting the effective exponent, I'm just taking the power, I'm taking the log of the power, and I'm averaging over angles, and I'm scaling it by the applied strain, again, because if you're adding up incoherent patterns, you expect things to just scale with the elapsed time. And what you see is that when I try to normalize by the applied strain, I get a fairly good, it almost collapses the data, but again, there must be some kind of residual correlation, so things are not adding up completely incoherently. But if we allow for a fudge factor, then I get a very nice collapse of my angle averaged exponent, and so which turns out to be in the ballpark of 0.75, which is which I think is quite a bit lower than the exponent that the Damien and company get for the scaling of the structure factor. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Mark. Michael.
Do they get a number bigger than one?
I think they get a number bigger than one.
There's some problems with integrability when it gets bigger than one. So.
Okay, we'll have to look more closely. But so they also have some strange. They have a very particular kind of functional form for the angle dependence. That.
So is it a bad way to think of it to say that? On the direction of maximum shear, you have things correlated over the length of the system, and so you have to sort of accommodate some kind of peak at low Q. Is that not? And then for the off.
Well, you would imagine. So the simplest
shear directions, you just sort of have baseline noise. I mean.
So I think for me, the simplest picture that could have played out, that didn't play out, that we were hoping would play out, was that you would see these guys cross over to flat if you went to small enough Q, large enough wavelength, right? So that really all the power at the very longest wavelengths was going to be on that. There would really only be one scaling exponent. And that would correspond to the direction of maximal shear. And this is the picture. I think so that picture is consistent with what Damien was showing us. Is that there really is only one scaling exponent that corresponds to the line of maximal shear, and all these guys are just crossing over to white noise.
So the surprise is that
they look like they're fairly. No, the surprise is that we do get such a good, a reasonable power law over.
But I think what Michael's saying is correct. I mean, in most critical phenomena, you only find two exponents, right? You would find along one direction, you get one scaling exponent, and then sort of all other directions would be another. And so to see something that's varying continuously is what's unusual. But it sounds like Damien just sees effectively two exponents.
Well, I think, so they have some functional form that they...
But what they showed is fairly constant.
What they showed is fairly constant. I mean, so this is the data. They have some fit for how the slope of this depends on the orientation.
But Damien's model doesn't allow general slip in any direction.
Right.
It only allows for a slip along two directions.
It's pure shear. Everything is pure shear.
So, but in your system, you're not limiting it at all, so it can have slips along
any
direction.
Yeah, right.
All I'm saying is this somehow is a more typical critical behavior than what we see from just like equilibrium critical phenomena.
More typical, and it's also, so if you want to think about this, if you want to think about the exponent characterizing some sort of geometrical property of the system, it also becomes difficult to think about the whole spectrum of exponents. Right? Okay, so that was the end of part, let's call it 1b. So we're looking at the spatial structure of the vorticity field. And so what we showed is that you do get the power spectrum to look like you have a power law with an angle-dependent prefactor and an angle-dependent exponent. And it turns out that the exponent only cares about the resolved shear stress on a given orientation, whereas the prefactor looks like it knows about other physics. It knows about this Moore Coulomb law, which allows planes with a lower normal stress to slip more readily. and that we almost get a perfect collapse when we rescale the power by the total applied strain, but the fact that we don't get a perfect collapse is signifies that there is some residual correlation. Okay, so now on to the jam system. So here on the left, I've got a picture from Frederica Lechenot, who's a student with Olivier Dauchot at Saclay. And they're just essentially, they have glass disks, and they're vibrating a table with glass disks, and the disks are very close to the random closed packing point. And they've looked at sort of the kinds of interesting reorganizations that you get in systems like this. This is work from Adam Abade, who is a PhD student with Doug Durian at Penn, and so these sorts of patterns, what they're doing is they're looking at they have a container full of ping pong balls, and they're vibrating, they're jiggling around the ping pong balls. The ping pong balls are close to their random closed packing point, and just like you see in supercooled liquids, you see these sort of swirly chain-like motions as you get close to jamming. If you're looking at displacements over on the order of alpha relaxation time, you see these sort of swirly kinds of motions. So the question is, when we have these other sorts of systems where there's other interesting physics, do we any of what we just talked about in the Leonard Jones system, does it remain, right? So what's left and what's completely out the window? So here is a picture. So this is a sheared disordered bubble raft. This is from Martin Van Hecke's group. And so a couple things that I would take home from this movie, and I hope that you all can take home too, is that number one, when they're shearing these bubbles, despite the fact that they're in the vicinity of the jamming transition, although this picture sort of might not be as close as I would like, but anyway, so they're in the vicinity of the jamming transition, I still see that we have spatially correlated rearrangements, number one, and number two, the rearrangement events are quite bursty, right? So it looks like the system has periods where it's being just loaded elastically, and then it'll snap, it'll rearrange, right? And so the question is, how do we reconcile all of that? Yeah.
What is that picture? What are you supposed to think of? The far right.
So this stuff here.
Yeah.
So this is just the standard sort of the standard sorts of rearrangements you see in supercooled liquids. So the string-like. So these are so this picture, he's just plotting the displacement field as measured on the alpha relaxation time in these ping pong ball systems, right? So you see these sort of swirly. I'm sorry.
Also, the bottom one.
No, sorry. So this one. Yes. And so these are some other measures of rearrangement. So there were, you know, so this is a paper by Doug Durian and Sharon Glotzer and company, and they looked at, you know, three or four different ways of characterizing structural decorrelation, and they showed that, you know, there were, you know, I think most of these captured the essential physics. So if you used any of these to define kind of a chi-4, you would get, you know, essentially the same. Same susceptibilities.
They're definitely not in the AQS limit.
These are definitely, so these here are certainly not in the AQS limit. So I don't even know if I would call them athermal, because so...
Temperature itself is not a quantity.
But if so, I would almost say if something's athermal, if I don't drive it with shear, or if I don't drive it with, you know, something, then it's not going to do anything. So. Right. Right.
And you're getting noisy responses.
Right. So I guess the question, in my worldview, the only kind of drive is applied shear strain, right? So this is sort of a third, but this is the third kind of thing.
But to get to the EQS, yeah. You defined before,
yeah.
You'd have to drive very, very slowly. And I maintain that you don't see delocalized events.
But I think in these, so I think a fair way to think about these systems would just be if you had real hard spheres, right? And so I don't know what it means to be athermal if they're real hard spheres. I mean, they're just exploring the accessible configuration space, right?
I thought that's the one language you guys have been using.
Yeah.
I'm just doing it. I think what I'm told. It's the athermal is what you know. Temperature of the system, so that if I let it sit without driving it, I wouldn't see any motion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, you're driving it, you're seeing very noisy motion. I think
I suppose I guess I would. Yeah, it depends on what the nature of the drive is, right? So in our case, we have a very homogeneous kind of drive, and in this case, the drive that they're imposing is it's a different.
I think the difference, the further distinction that can be made is if you have, if the system is driven or not, whether you have the presence of thermal-like motions of the particles, which can contribute to rearrangement,
right.
In addition to sort of more deterministic.
So in that sense, I would call these thermal like, in the sense that if I did a simulation of a supercooled liquid, I would imagine that I would see with a real temperature, I would imagine I'd see similar sort of reorganization patterns. And so the take home is that I just want to point out that even though I might have these systems and they're close to the jamming transition, so naively you might expect the same sorts of geometrical rearrangements that you see in the ping pong balls. The important point is that, I missed the bullet point. There's supposed to be another bullet that appeared right here. The important point is that, since these guys are in a shear flow, there's a shear stress. When you have a shear stress, you're, dramatically breaking the isotropy of space, right? So you have there are principal stress axes of the stress tensor, and these really select out one versus the other of the Cartesian axes of the system. And so you should not necessarily expect these sort of, the same swirly kinds of patterns in systems where you have a well-developed shear stress. Okay, and so the jamming idea, so I know there was some talk about this a few weeks back, but I'll just do a lightning review. So in this sort of phase diagram here, I stole this from Klaus Heusinger and Jean-Louis Barra. This was a PRL in 2009, but anyway, so the axes here in this phase diagram are the packing fraction of the particles. So I'm always thinking now about a collection of purely repulsive particles, and if I don't force them to overlap, the interactions are completely trivial and the system falls apart, right? So I'm confining the system. And so here's my packing fraction, and here's the shear stress that I'm applying. And at sufficiently large packing fractions, I have a well-defined yield stress. So if I'm below that yield stress, my packing doesn't shear. In some sense, it's jammed. It has a finite elasticity, finite elastic modulus, and it doesn't start to flow until the shear stress gets above some yield point. And so here I've drawn that yield point with this, or actually Klaus and Jean-Louis have drawn that yield point with this. This curve right here, but there is a special packing fraction below which, no matter how gently I drive the system, it will always flow. Right? So the system has effectively fallen apart. There's no elasticity anymore, and so we just spent a lot of time talking about this limit here, where we're approaching yield above the random close packing point. We were actually talking about Leonard Jones, but we've, in other work we've shown that in these repulsive systems, as long as you're dense enough, they pretty much behave just like Leonard Jones. So the question is, in the repulsive systems, when you get close to the random close packing point, what of the transient slip lines that I've been talking about remains, if anything? Okay, and so what happens, what's known, is that when you get close to this random close packing point, you get scaling in the rheology that appears very much like the standard scaling you see in critical phenomena. So if you look at the stress versus strain curve, or here, this is from Olson and Peitel, they plot the inverse viscosity as a function of shear stress, and so you've got a bunch of curves over here. So these guys, these systems over here on this side of the dotted line, as you decrease the shear stress, the inverse viscosity goes to zero, the viscosity diverges, it's going towards the yield stress, right? So these guys are yielding as you bring the stress down. These guys are going to constant viscosity as you bring the stress down, so these guys are Newtonian, effectively. So you've got Newtonian, and you've got systems that are going through yield stress, right? So these guys are the jam systems that are above phi c. These guys are the flowing systems that are below phi c. And what Olson and Peitel showed is that you can do a scaling collapse if I scale the stress by delta rho to the capital delta, and if I scale the inverse viscosity by delta rho to the beta. I have the jam curves and the flowing curves completely collapsing, which is telling us that the distance away from the jamming transition is setting both a characteristic stress scale for the problem, and it's setting a characteristic viscosity scale, or in this case, since I've already got a stress scale set, you can say that it's setting an effective time scale. What it's telling me is that the system is becoming very, very sluggish as I approach the jamming transition, and there's an effective time scale that's diverging.
Same scaling that
Lovick, Berthier,
and Witten do for
their... So I don't know... Yes, I don't...
But not quite. I think the horizontal axis is for them.
Yeah, tell us.
But they were doing...
So there were some...
They weren't doing nonlinear systems. They were doing,
yes, relaxation. They had nothing to do with stress.
There was, yes, yeah, so it was
the
temperature. Okay, but so
I'm trying to figure out, but I think they're called relaxation times.
Well, it's the SM relaxation time versus something like that. It's sort of taking us off the track at this one. There may be a connection.
But so I think, you know, for our purposes, the important point is that you've got a vanishing stress scale, and you have a diverging time scale. And so can you have these, you know, so the mechanism, the basic mechanism that made for these, you know, these slip bands is effectively elasticity, right? So you have some kind of yielding, the locations, the material that yield communicate with other locations via elasticity. And when you have, you know, the elasticity going away on you, what happens? Okay, so that's the question we're trying to answer here. And we will answer that via some simulations with Durian's bubble model. And I'm going to use what's called a mean field variant of Durian's bubble model. And I've gotten some, you know, some friction, no pun intended, some friction from some people for using this model instead of using something that might be more realistic for soap bubbles. But the way Durian's bubble model works for people who haven't seen it before, so the interaction between these particles, so I have effectively a harmonic repulsion. So if my disks overlap, they repel via some harmonic spring. And otherwise, I drive them via a homogeneous shear flow. And if the particles, so here's my homogeneous flow, if my particles deviate from that homogeneous flow, there is a restoring force that's proportional to the, some restoring force that tries to restore the particles to the affine profile, and then the forces induced by the other particles must balance with these forces that are trying to drag the particles along affinely, and that's effectively how the mean field version of Durian's bubble model works. So things to point out, I'm working with a 50-50 bidispersed mixture where the big particles are 1.4 times bigger than the small particles. That should be a 1.0 sigma naught there, sorry, so the big particles are 1.4 times bigger. It's a very standard mixture that people have done a lot of work on recently. And so I'll just explain the drag force. And so there's only one time scale in the model that's given by this this drag coefficient. And so when I measure strain rates, I'm going to be measuring strain rates in terms of this viscous dissipation time. So my naive dimensionless strain rates are really what a rheologist would call the Deber number. Okay. So here I have two systems, and I'm slow in a naive sense, right? Meaning that the Deber number is basically as small as I could reasonably make it, given the computing resources that I had, which is about 10 to the minus 6 in my naive strain rate units. Okay, so here's a system that's very dense, and here's a system that's very close to this random close packing point. Okay, and so over here, what I see is effectively the same sort of behavior that we see in the Leonard Jones, right? So I see smooth elastic loading with occasional bursty intermittent rearrangements. And those rearrangements are sort of correlated, and eventually they form into these transient shear bands that I was talking about. Now here, for the system that's close to the jamming point, what you see is not as obviously intermittent, right? So you see that the system's sort of always continually rearranging, and you could imagine, well, I think I can imagine when I look at this, that the rearrangements are always somehow spatially correlated. Right, so over here, I have elastic loading with bursty correlated rearrangements, spatially correlated rearrangements, and here the system is more or less always rearranging, but there are non-trivial spatial correlations in the rearrangement. Okay, so. Well, so like if you look, so I.
Do you mean that they're not? It's non-localized.
Yeah. So if you watch this system here, you'll see a nice row that's sort of sliding all at one time. So if you sort of, there's a nice one that comes up here. You know, I would like to be more quantitative about this, but because of the numerical constraints, I haven't been able to go to systems as big as we went in the Leonard Jones with these soft sphere models. Because near jamming, for technical reasons, I like to keep the time step small. Not I like to keep the time step small. I observe that when I take the time step up a little bit into the regime where I'd like to get it so that I could get, you know, get reasonable statistics, I start to see the time step in my MD simulation become relevant. So
it was done very quantitatively by you, in fact. The event size is scaling with the size of the system.
But this was always for the funny quasi-static energy minimization business, right? And this was always well away from the jamming transition. So two things. So this is continuous strain, or at least as continuous as you can make it in a computer, number one. And number two, we're close to jamming, right? So what I was looking at before was not particularly close to jamming and was using this funny step-relax protocol. Okay.
So this is real
dynamics during Durian bubble model.
There's also no friction.
There's no friction. So it's the mean field Durian bubble model. So there are many intricacies you could put on top. So you could do non-mean field Durian bubble model. You could do Durian bubble model with friction. You could put in some mass. So those are all sort of zero temperature. This is sort of the simplest zero temperature that I could imagine. And so this is the same model that Olson and Teitel did all their work on.
So
We'll talk.
5 minutes, I guess, or something.
Okay. So to remove the affine shear that you're applying.
Yes.
What prevents you from just sort of doing the usual kind of analysis you can use to look at correlated, especially correlated
You can. So if you're asking me, why don't I just look at the velocity autocorrelation function?
No,
I'm sorry. Yeah. But this, so for instance, that's what Olson entitled. I'm sorry?
Mobility correlation.
Mobility, so if I look at structural decorrelation and I look at the correlations of local structural decorrelation, I could do that. So the thing that Olson and Teitel have looked at is they've looked a lot at the velocity autocorrelation function with Klaus Heusinger and Jean-Louis Barat have also looked at the velocity autocorrelation function. They've shown that has some interesting dependence on the density and the shearing rate. But I just am not. I'm not confident that I could get up to interesting system sizes to compare with the sort of scaling analysis we did with the Leonard Jones. I mean, Leonard Jones, we were 1,000 by 1,000, and we got a decade of scaling. Here, this is like a 40 by 40 system, and 40 by 40 is about as good as I can do right now, at least getting good statistics on, you know, many machines.
Is this fixed volume, or do you let it dial?
So this is all fixed volume. So
also the previous ones always fixed volume.
Also previous ones were always fixed volume, right? And so here I don't initialize it to your pressure. I initialize it just some fixed density, and everything forever is at fixed density. Okay. Okay. So. take home is that for the very dense systems, I hope when you guys look at this, you can believe that there's something similar to what was going on in Leonard Jones, and that at the systems close to jamming, there's certainly less bursty behavior at these naively low shear rates. Okay.
Can you look at distributions as a function of heat phi?
Yes.
Okay.
And I will show this. Yes.
Great.
Okay, so the first thing to look at, again, is just I'm looking at the PDF of displacement. So here, in my shear flow, just to be simple so that, you know, effects of Taylor diffusion are out the window, I'm just going to look at vertical motion, right? So I'm looking at vertical PDFs of vertical displacements for my two different systems that I was just showing you, the very dense one and the dilute one. So the dense one is going to be the dotted, the dilute is going to be solid, and these are for different time intervals. So the black is for an applied strain of 1.25 times 10 to the minus 4, and so on and so forth. So I'm going all the way up to strains of 8 times 10 to the minus 3. And what you see is that at short times, the densely compressed system, the tails are a lot bigger than the dilute system, right? So here's my dilute system, here's my dense system. So it looks like the fluctuations in the dense system are somehow much bigger. But as I go to larger and larger time scales, going from black to red to green to blue, eventually it looks like I get to a similar, when I'm in the diffusive Fickian regime, it looks like, number one, I get to a similar mean squared displacement, right? So the effective diffusion constant appears to be similar in these two systems, even though the short time dynamics looks a lot different. And number two, it looks like the, that's all I want to say now. So it looks like they're crossing over to a similar distribution. Okay. Yes.
I'm trying to understand.
Yeah.
Even in supercooled liquids, if you look at different displacement distributions over different time scales,
right.
I thought you showed some data earlier, but intermediate times the tails are fatter, and as you go to larger times, you go crossover to a Gaussian distribution.
Correct. Yes.
Is that what you're seeing here?
That is what I'm seeing, right? But so at the short times, the exponential tails, if you believe that's what's going on, is you have some kind of core with exponential tails, the tails are much broader for the system that is dense.
Okay.
Right? And so that effect of the dense system having broader tails goes away eventually at later times, which isn't so, that's not so surprising in and of itself. But what's interesting, I think, is that it crosses over to distribution with the same RMS.
The dashed lines are the densest.
I'm sorry, the solid lines are dense. Wait, strike that. I'm sorry. Yes. The dotted lines are dense and the solid lines are dilute.
Okay, so if you compare time by time, but is there a way to compare some scale time?
I don't know. That's an open question. That's an open question, but you might... I should say no, because I'll show you, we have plots of the non-Gaussian parameter as a function of, for different densities as a function of strain rate and as a function of strain. You can see that, you know, the shapes of those things are not, you know, in one case it's non-monotonic, so there's no simple rescaling. Okay. So those are the PDFs, and so the question is: if I just look at the first two non-trivial moments, so I look at the second and the fourth moment. So here's the dense system, and what you see. So I'm plotting the second moment, the fourth moment for the different different strain rates. So here you see those same strain rates that we were looking at before. So I'm plotting for different strain rates. So in the bottom plot here, I'm taking the appropriate ratio of those two moments that if I have a Gaussian distribution, I expect to go to 1. So it's not exactly the non-Gaussian parameter. It's not the kurtosis of the distribution, but it's the kurtosis plus 1. And so this should go to, this object should go to 1 if I have a Gaussian distribution. What you can see is that all the different strain rates for the dense system, I'm crossing over to the Fickian limit at about the same strain. So at about 0.1 applied strain, I cross over to something that's Fickian, and I get an effective diffusion coefficient. And if I run the same argument that I ran with the Leonard Jones, it tells me that given the effective diffusion coefficient that I measure, I'm sorry, here's my second moment. So here's my second moment, so I back out a diffusion coefficient. It tells me that I've got a slip amplitude that's about the same order of magnitude as it was in Leonard Jones, right? Something on the order of the particle size, right? So if you believe the argument that I have, that I have slip lines in the system, it tells me that the amplitude of those slip lines is 0.8 times the particle size. And it also tells me that I can back out some sort of characteristic crossover if I, I shouldn't say characteristic crossover, but there's a characteristic rate of events, or this is an inverse rate of events, of 5%, right? So on average, every 5%, I have to have one of these slip lines if they take up all the implied strength. Yeah.
But the displacements of, for example, in this granular, 2D granular system of Olivier Duchaux, or in the Lennard-Jones simulations, the jump length seems to be much smaller.
Yeah, so these are not the avalanches. So I think there's a similar thing in Duchaux's work, right? So there are two processes. So one process is sort of the elementary process, right? The avalanches themselves. These avalanches build up into the slip lines. And so I'm plotting, so everything I'm showing you here starts at an applied strain of 10 to the minus 3. Okay, so my characteristic, my characteristic strain for the interval between these transient slip lines is 5%, right? And so everything we're looking at here, I don't know. So I'd have to look more carefully at what object it was. So you're saying that there were discrete jumps they were looking at, and the size of the discrete jumps was something much smaller than this. But those discrete jumps, the question is, how do those discrete jumps relate to these these shear bands that I'm looking at? I don't know. But it'd be interesting to take a look at that. Okay, but anyway, so we have a characteristic interval between these guys of 5% strain. And so that was all for, this was all for the dense system. So I'm looking at the different rates. My non-Gaussian parameter looks like it crosses over the thickened regime at about 0.1 applied strain. And if I look in space, typically, and again, because I don't have large enough systems to satisfy me, I haven't done this systematically, but if we just look at a case study here, so I'm plotting the vertical displacements in one of these windows that's on my characteristic strain time, and you see that you do get something with a slip amplitude about what you would expect based on the diffusion argument that more or less spans the system. So here's one of these transient slip lines, and I'd like to go to a bigger system, but for the system size I have, I think this is at least consistent with the picture that you have these bands that form on the strain scale of 5%. I'm sorry?
What density?
This is the dense system. This is the same one we were looking at. So it's very, packing fraction of one, so very far away from the jamming point. Okay, so now that was the very dense system. Let's look at the dilute system. So if we go from a density of 1 down to 0.85, which is very close to the jamming transition, we see a couple things. So first of all, so we saw already that the tails were not nearly as broad as the tails in the dense system. So you can see that the fourth moment is way down. It's on the order of the second moment here. If I look at my non-Gaussian parameter, it's much smaller in magnitude, so the dense system was much more non-Gaussian in displacement distribution at short times. But you can even see there's different, the shape is different, so I almost have a hint of non-monotonic behavior in my non-Gaussian parameter. So if you look in supercooled liquids, there's usually non-Gaussian behavior, and there's some characteristic time at which the displacements are most non-Gaussian. So if there is such a similar time here, in these guys, it must be at much smaller strain scales that I'm not interested in, per se. But we see, again, I get a crossover to the Fickian regime at about the same strain. So these systems, although they show different short-time dynamics, over longer times, it looks like things may be organizing into these slip bands to give you a crossover at about the same strain. Right? And so if you look again on this characteristic strain scale, which backing out from the diffusion constant is about 5%, and if I look at a typical displacement here, so here's my dense system, here's my dilute system, again, I see displacements that are about the right amplitude for one of these slip lines, and I do see an object here that's extending through a reasonable fraction of the system. So again, I'd like to be more quantitative about these guys, but I think with the current system sizes I have, it's probably not worth it. And so, just to do a side-by-side comparison of the non-Gaussian parameter for the dense system, which is much less Gaussian than the dilute system. The dilute system's here, but they tend to cross over to the Fichtian regime at about the same point. And this mechanism of organization into the slip lines is a natural way to explain that. Okay, and so I think in the interest of time, I'll just end. So this was part 2A. I didn't have time to get to 2B, but so for the conclusions for part 2A. So in the systems near random close packing, the slip line argument would tell you that there's a backing out from the diffusion constant what the slip amplitude would be. The slip amplitude would be about 0.8 particle diameters, which is on the same order of magnitude as we saw in the Leonard-Jones. So this gives you, at least for this system size, I have a quantum of strain that's about 5%. So you have, on average, you have one of these slip lines forming every 5% applied strain. And the displacement fields, if I look on that strain scale, they look like what you would expect. I would like to be more quantitative in bigger systems, but at least this is consistent. I think the take-home message is this really seems surprisingly robust with respect to being close to jamming. Close to jamming, you see very different short-time dynamics. But at longer times, it seems like somehow the physics conspires to allow some kind of effective elasticity to, you know, have communication between these slips to let the plasticity organize into these transient slip lines. Okay, so that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Any question?
Would you argue that the shear band we discussed in the very beginning is dimensional plane, actually? So when you change in your system from 2D to 3D, in the water seep pictures, nothing happens? Is that the argument? So
people have done a lot of work on the 3D, and what you see in 3D is that there's a, well, so I haven't talked so much here about the event size distribution, but if you look at the distribution of the size of the plastic rearrangement events, sort of like elementary events, in these quasi-static simulations, what you see is that in 2D, you get a typical event size that scales with the length of the system. You'd imagine in 3D, if you just naively, you know, projected the argument up, that you would get, you know, if slip organized into planes instead of organizing into lines, you'd imagine the event size should scale like L squared. It turns out that in 3D, the event size scales like L to something between 1 and 2. Right? So it may be that the slip organizes into you know, some sort of fractal objects that are in between lines and planes when you go to 3D systems. And so, yeah, of course, that'll affect the...
But your main arguments in the first part would hold in...
My main arguments in the first part. No, so I'm not sure. But so the relating an effective diffusion constant to a slip amplitude. So the slip amplitude is really it's like a Burgers vector. It's a quantum of slip. I don't think that you can directly, without understanding more about the geometry of the object, say more about the relationship between the effective diffusion constant and the, you know, the amplitude of what? If you're in 3D, in 2D, it's the, you know, the amount of slip on a line. If you're in 3D, you know, who knows? It could be that, you know, you might have small pockets of something slipping. So it's a, you know, I think there are many more options in that case. In 2D, the picture is geometrically simple. You just have a line, right? So.